You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Tuesday, April 10th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, I am undoubtedly enjoying my time with my family, or possibly doubtedly enjoying my time with my family. But that doesn't mean that you won't get to enjoy two new great interviews pre-recorded last week that you've never heard before. That's right. First up, we'll be talking to the filmmakers of Queen of the Sun. What are the bees telling us? It's April, folks. Where are all the bees? They're important. And filmmakers Taggart Siegel and John Betts will tell us just how important. And it's just one more story of how corporations, in their singly-minded pursuit of profits, are dumping externalities on the rest of us. In this case, they're killing the bees. And the bees are very, very important. Also on the program today, Chris Mooney, author of The Republican Brain, The Science of Why They Deny Science and Reality. Well, here's one good reason why you would deny science. Because it would tell you that there are certain corporate pesticides that are killing off the bees. And if you allow the science to prevail, then you'd lose some profits. So sit back, enjoy first an interview with the filmmakers of Queen of the Sun, and then the author, Chris Mooney. Tomorrow on the program, you'll hear Jessica Valenti, author of The Purity Myth, Congressman Keith Ellison, and insurance industry whistleblower Wendell Potter. So we'll see you tomorrow, and enjoy these two interviews now. Taggart Siegel. He is the director, and John Betts, the producer of Queen of the Sun, What Are the Bees Telling Us? A documentary that is out now. Is that right, John?
Yes. The film's now available on DVD and digital, so you're able to watch it online, and you can also purchase it from a variety of outlets, including our website and Amazon and all those places.
All right, great. And we'll have a link up on majority.fm for that. So, Taggart, let's start with you. Tell me, what is it that inspired you to do a documentary. I know you had done a you had directed the Real Dirt on Farmer John, which what forced you to, or what compelled you, I guess, to do a documentary about bees?
Well, it was exactly that. Like, if you look at agriculture, it seems that one of the things that I was missing was the bee element, the pollinator element. I followed Farmer John for a number of years, and it was incredible learning about organic farming and biodynamic farming. But what I didn't realize that pollinators were the one of the crucial components to farming. And so when I read an article, the bees were dying out, and in 2007, a colony collapse disorder where millions and millions of bees were dying out, and it still is happening the same way, I thought, like, this is the most important documentary that needs to be made at this point. So I basically just picked up the camera soon after that, and I filmed for 2 years, 2.5 years, just exploring around the world, like, what is colony collapse disorder and why has it been, why is it happening?
And in fact, John, it just coincidentally speaking, I mean, this has got to be well timed, particularly from a producer's standpoint. The EPA has recently come out, or I should say, there are two new studies that have come out in Science Magazine just in the recent days that are at least, if not conclusively, certainly showing that one of the functions of colony collapse disorder is our neonicotinoids, I guess.
Yes, you're absolutely correct. You're right. It's amazing they've really come out in full force. I was reading, you know, the New York Times today. They're hitting a lot of the major papers, and it's about time, because I think from when we started making this film in 2007, we had a very good sort of feeling and evidence that the neonicotinoids were one of the prime suspects, and studies have continued to come out with more and more direction pointing that these systemic pesticides, which are they're actually become part of the plant, they're in all of the tissues of the plant, they're in the nectar, there's no getting rid of those pesticides once they're in the plant, and they affect bees. And the rules that the EPA sets is that they can't, you know, kill bees immediately, obviously they can't be used. Well, the problem with these neonicotinoid pesticides, and what's made it so hard to sort of conclude with studies that they're killing bees, is that it's a slow process. It's sort of like a long-term picture that you have to evaluate. So these new studies, what makes them really compelling is that they are tracking bees over the course of weeks after their exposure to pesticides and realizing that there's a considerable die-off happening as a result of that exposure. And I think many, many, many beekeepers knew this to be the case long ago, but the scientific community is really waking up at this point, which is very good news, for everyone fighting this battle, because hopefully we can get politicians to wake up and more of the scientific community to get behind studies like these.
And Taggart, these neonicotinoids I guess one of the main culprits is clothianidin. Forgive me, my incapacity to pronounce these things. What are they used for? I mean, are they? Why are these new type of systemic pesticides being used?
Well, they're being used because many of the big monoculture companies that are producing seeds, they coat the seeds with a pesticide that goes into the plant. So it's systemically, when the plant grows, it systemically goes throughout the whole plant. And so, for example, corn, the BT corn, is this covered with pesticide when it grows to a full corn. And the bees, they don't pollinate they don't pollinate the corn because corn is wind pollinated, but they do gather up corn pollen. And when they gather up the corn pollen, that's where the pesticides are, like, really, it's part of the whole plant. So the bees take that in, and they take that in as food, and that food is laden with pesticide, and it really creates devastating effects on their memory and how to navigate back to the hive. Their gut organisms get kind of, like, rotten because of the enzymes are different for them, especially when they're kind of turning it into honey. They're using their enzymes to turn that nectar into honey. And so the bees are just like being clobbered from so many directions from all these pesticides that are being applied on crops all over the world.
And for those of us, Taggart, who aren't necessarily familiar with the value or the importance of pollinators, just give us a sense of just how important a role they play in basically providing us with food.
Well, as Michael Pollan says in Queen of the Sun, you know, every fourth bite that you take is pollinated by bees. 40% of all crops are pollinated by bees, if not more. We've heard up to 3/4 of all crops are pollinated by bees or pollinators. And so it's vital to our well-being that the agriculture will continue on, because without the pollinators, it will not. I mean, we'll basically be able to eat wheat and corn and soy, but we're not going to have the diversity of food if we don't have the pollinators. So they are intrinsically important, and not only just our food system, but for forests and many, many things depend on those forests for food, the birds and the butterflies and all the animal species. So if the pollinators start dying out, then the birds will start dying out. It'll just be this kind of mass die-off, which that needs to be stopped.
And John, I wonder, and Taggart, you can answer this too if you're more familiar with it, but I recently read, I think it was in the New York Times, that there's a new study that shows that mercury, which we have prior thought was only a problem in the ecosystem with our fish, because the mercury from coal-fired power plants essentially gathers in some of these larger fishes as they eat smaller fishes, and makes them in some ways poisonous enough to recommend that pregnant women don't eat any fish when they're pregnant because of this mercury and the implications on the neurology of kids, essentially. And there's been new finding that the mercury has been also sort of becoming concentrated in the forests. And as insects and other bugs, and perhaps bees, I don't know, and that's what I want to ask you, ingest this, the birds that then ingest it lose their neurological capacity to find their nests, to hit a proper note if they're a songbird that attracts other songbirds, and to propagate. Does that play in at all? I mean, do you have any sense as to whether or not mercury is also affecting the sort of the neurology of bees as well?
You know, it's interesting to hear that from you and to sort of hear the explanation coming from, you know, what we've heard from fish for quite some time. You know, I have a 1-year-old daughter, so I'm very familiar with the issue with pregnant women and mercury. And I myself haven't read anything. I don't know if you have, Tegger, but it sounds very likely to me. You know, and without, you know, making a statement one way or the other, I would say that we've got a situation in nature where nature works off a food chain that's very, very intricate, very, very smartly designed in a way. But when we start to take control, as we have with the industrial, you know, food complex, with the way that we work with nature, our tendency is to be very short-sighted about things. And we like to control, maximize efficiency, and get what we want out of the systems around us. It's just like our natural human impulse. And in doing that, we we really are short-sighted about what some of the effects of things we're doing have. And it's really an approach of innocent until proven guilty on a lot of things, but we almost need to reframe it to really look at, you know, are we sure things aren't causing harm before we're doing them, rather than doing them until we realize that they're causing harm, as sort of our MO with how we approach nature.
And if you look at the EPA, they've known for 9 years that that these neonicotinoids kill bees. But they just kind of were very complacent about it and let the big corporations really just do whatever they want. And people have known for years. I mean, think of Rachel Carson's book, The Silent Spring, that was published in 1960s. That was when DDT was a big factor. And so have we really learned from the use of pesticides? I mean, it just continues on and on and on. So I think finally it seems that people are really getting fed up, and we have to do something about this.
Is it, Taggart, let me ask you this. Is it a question of an incapacity for people? I mean, I imagine part of this problem is a lack of awareness of people, and your film, Queen of the Sun, is one of those things that hopefully will educate people to the importance of bees and to the challenges, and maybe that's understating it, that they're facing. But is part of it also simply that there is just so much corporate money that tries to hide and to, you know, it's one thing to say that the EPA has been complacent. It's another to say that on some level they are responding more to the corporate influence that influences all of our regulatory bodies in this country, sadly, because of the power of these corporations.
Well, yes. I mean, if you really think about the whole corporate sort of paradigm, the agricultural paradigm, we've recently been doing research on for our new documentary on seeds, and as you know, there's the elite group of corporate interests that own, you know, something like 56% of the global seed market, and it's like where has the ownership? It's been taken away from us, the freedom of having seeds that are locally produced and adapted, that really create a healthy ecosystem. And a lot of that has been taken away by these big corporations that have bought up seed companies. And these seeds can produce like millions and millions of seeds from that one seed. And because of pollinators, those one seeds can turn into the millions. And that's as Vandana Shiva says, it's the economics of of democracy. It's the economics of sharing, that this is a really healthy system that nature has put in place. And the corporate control is really trying to control everything and to sort of create this system where eventually it will probably collapse, because they're only using a few seed stocks. They're so hybridized and genetically engineered that ultimately they get weaker and weaker too. And, you know, every time they bring out a new seed coated with these pesticides that are supposed to kill the insect that's attacking it, eventually that insect just grows stronger and figures out a way to take on that plant again. So my feeling is that we need to really kind of recreate our agricultural system so it's back to being a culture again, where people have these heirloom seeds and these seeds that are going to protect humanity into the future. But if we leave it in the hands of corporate agriculture control, I really think it could all collapse.
John, tell me when you started this project, what have you learned about bees that not just that you didn't know before, but that genuinely surprised you, or I should say honeybees, that you found rather surprising?
Well, you know, it's funny as a documentarian coming into making a film, and I think this is true with Taggart as well. We talk about this quite a bit when we go in to make a film. You can come in from different perspectives, but oftentimes we'll come into a film really not knowing anything. And we'll look for those people who can help us learn more about what's going on, for instance, with colony collapse disorder in this case. And so it's an incredible like journey of discovery to make a film every time, and you're constantly challenged because in order to make a film, you have to become an expert. And so in this case, we were talking to beekeepers all across the globe, and they just have, I think one of the most surprising things to me was actually the relationship that beekeepers have with their beehives. It's not something that I think we would intuitively think of when we think of an insect, but they have this relationship that is, you know, much like someone might have with a dog or a cat that's been with them their whole life, where hives have personalities. Some hives are more aggressive. Some hives are more passive. Some are more productive and bring in more honey. And the beekeeper knows the hives when he opens them up and is able to work with them. And in fact, a lot of the beekeepers that we filmed in the film don't even wear a lot of protective gear, you know, the sort of classic spaceman bee suit that you see so often. A lot of people did not wear that because they were so comfortable and knew their bees so well. And so it was things like that that really kind of created a magic in that world, because anytime you go into the natural world, I think we're constantly surprised with how incredibly intelligent the systems already are. In the case of pollinators, there's so much in the design of the beehive that is just built for maximum efficiency and survival. And I think that's why bees have become so much of a model for all of us, just from the hexagonal shape, which is a perfect structural shape, and provides the maximum area for the most honey to be stored. To the way that they cap honey at a certain humidity, the fact that honey never goes bad, it's antiseptic, so 2,000-year-old honey is still edible today. I mean, the list goes on, and the discoveries, for both of us, I think were just part of what made making this film such a incredible experience beyond just the, you know, kind of apocalyptic ramifications of bees dying off. Bees are just such a warm and incredibly interesting creature. I think that's what for us kept us going nonstop in making Queen of the Sun.
Taggart, I know that you followed beekeepers from across the globe. Was there any particular beekeepers that stood out for you? Was the similarities between those beekeepers from across different cultures what struck you? Tell me about some of those characters that you spoke to.
Well, they were all like in love with their bees. And so when they're in love, they do strange things. And so one beekeeper, Yvon Huchard, is a yogi. He's a Frenchman. He's a bee historian. He teaches. He explained bees in the most poetic ways. In fact, he would recite Rumbo to his bees, and then he brought his bees out, a frame of the bees. There were probably 1,000 bees on the frame, and he tickles them with his mustache. And that kind of interaction was just like, you know, I didn't ask him to do it. He just was doing it. And he was he chanted to his bees, a Hindu chant, and just, you know, he's 70 years old, but just, he looks like 40. He's just beautiful. And then you have the beekeeper like Gunther Hawk, who has started this Spikenard honeybee sanctuary, and he's the most beautiful, insightful man into biodynamic beekeeping, which is a process of really respecting and loving the bees. So you really have to take it away from the industrial model that's been set up with commercial beekeepers that ship their bees across the country in big, you know, big trucks, and they take them to Central Valley to pollinate the almond fields for that 2-week period. But the bees are under a lot of stress. They're fed like corn syrup And as Michael Pollan said, nothing more viscerally offensive than feeding the creators of honey corn syrup. But these beekeepers that we mostly followed were reverential. They loved their bees, and they learned to work with them in a way that it's not about taking and what can we get out of the bees. It's really about what the bees are giving us as a gift. And they often saw them as messengers to the heavens. That connection that the Mayans had and the Egyptians had go back thousands of years, and that's what we lost in the industrial age, and that's what a lot of beekeepers, which I'm starting to see, is starting to return to that, almost like they're worshiping bees again. And that's why I made the film, is to follow these incredible beekeepers in New Zealand, in Australia, in all over Europe, United States, that absolutely love their bees. But when they love their bees so much, it's the tragic implication of what is happening to these bees that are so tragic.
And John, what can people do? What can your average person do? Short of pressuring the EPA to get these type of pesticides off the market, what can people do to help bees? Help bees help us, I guess would be the way to phrase it.
People can do a lot just with what they've got at their fingertips. I think one of the major things that industrial agriculture, huge monocultures, and our detachment from food has done to us is we don't grow our own gardens anymore. We don't plant as many flowers as we used to. And so habitat in the suburban landscape and the urban landscape is disappearing for bees. And so one of the hugest problems for not just honeybees, but native pollinators, mason bees, bumblebees, is that there is just not this habitat that there used to be. So that's I think one of the simplest ways we can all actually make a difference. Aside from, like you said, there's signing petitions is a very important political way, but it doesn't doing that oftentimes doesn't bring the issue home into the core of who you are, like going out and actually working to see differences, to see bees in your yard, in your garden, on your window plant or outside of your apartment, wherever it is you can make a difference. And beyond that, I think we have a lot of choices to make as consumers, and this comes into the argument of sustainable food production and food consumption. And bees, because they are really the insects and creatures that we owe our food to in a major way, and I don't think we think about that enough when we consume. And so it's not just organic, because organic produce, as we all know, can still be grown in really vast monocultures that require you to truck in the bees and require, the beekeepers to then feed corn syrup to the bees and all of these things. The best way to go about it is to really be intentional about eating local, knowing your farmer, visit your farmer's market, ask them how things are grown, buy local raw honey from a beekeeper that you can actually talk to, and return to a way of buying food that's really a departure, a challenging departure from how we're used to doing it.
And I should say, Tagger, too, and we sort of have a small beekeeper following on our program. And I've since learned the problems of Chinese honey, that they filter it in a specific way to take out evidence that their bees have had to be treated with antibiotics, and it sort of diminishes the quality of the honey and the value of the honey.
Yes, and not only that, it's often not honey. It's often treated with sugar, too, or corn syrup. So those little cute little bears that you get into all those shops often come from Vietnam or China, and they're laden with pesticides, that honey. That's not the honey to be eating. The honey to be eating is, as John said, is the raw organic honey that you could find in some stores, in health food stores, but you could also find them at your local farmers markets. So, it's a really scary thing in China where they don't have pollinators in one region of the world where there's pears, and they have to hand pollinate the pear tree, the pear blossom, to create the fertility. And you know, that's a very scary thing to even think about. So it's just so important to get back to that local system and to become a beekeeper. I've become a beekeeper. If I could become a beekeeper, I imagine a lot of people could become a beekeeper. And it's really one of the most joyous things I've ever done, because my whole backyard now is dedicated to the bees, and I just keep planting more and more bee-friendly herbs and plants. And so
John, tell me, where can people get more information about the film and more information about what they can do to help bees?
Well, I think one of the hubs that we've been trying, that we've set up for the film, hold 1 second, we'll remove this. Hold on. So I'll start over there. I think we've set up a website to really have take action points for people, ways people can help, and ways that people can help share this film. So if you go to queenofthesun.com, we have a lot of information there for you to learn how you can host a screening of the film, how you can watch the film online, share it with your friends, get social about it, share it on Facebook, and really become part of a larger community. We have a very active Facebook page with thousands of followers. There's a constant dialogue there. You know, daily, almost daily community screenings happening for the film. And it's really, this film, I think, is a way to really spread awareness and galvanize your community around something like starting a local community farm, you know, community garden, or something to increase awareness of your farmer's market, and really to spread the word about the bees. So if you go to queenofthesun.com, you can find a lot of information about the film, sign up for our newsletter, and I'd like to add too that the DVD is available in many, many retailers, including Whole Foods stores, and online at Amazon, and so there's many places you can get the film. You can watch it digitally on iTunes and Amazon Instant, and so we really appreciate people supporting the film in that way.
And we'll of course put those links on majority.fm, and it's a great way to sort of help people enter into a higher consciousness of just how we get our food, and frankly all the other somewhat tangential but frankly direct issues about corporate control of not only of our government but of our daily lives. And Taggart Siegel, John Betts, the movie Queen of the Sun, thank you so much for taking the time with us.
Thank you so much, Sam.
Thank you, Sam.
Okay, joining me now is Chris Mooney. He is the author, or at least of his latest anyways, The Republican Brain, The Science of Why They Deny Science and Reality. He, of course, also wrote the 2005 New York Times bestseller, The Republican War on Science. He's written in the past for Mother Jones, Salon, American Prospect, Harper's, just about everywhere. Welcome to the program, Chris.
Thanks for having me.
So let's... You have a, I guess this book is really sort of taking your question and I guess your question and your almost your search as to why there is this right-wing conservative war on science. It's taking it a little bit further and perhaps finding some new answers.
I think so. I guess I'm cursed by a need to understand why. You know, people will believe and insist upon and rationalize things that are completely factually false about science, but also about, you know, claiming the president is not born in the United States.
Yeah, well,
and
so we
gotta go into the brain. Yeah.
Okay, well, we know. I mean, on some level, there's we know part of the reason why there's a Republican war on science, or at least perhaps from your first book, we do, and that, of course, is sort of it has to do with. There is actually, this is almost like a long-term investment for Republicans and for the Republicans, I guess, the establishment of the party.
Long-term investment in many senses, maybe. One of the things that they invested in that clearly drove denial of reality, and I talk about this in the Republican War on Science and the Republican Brain, is they created their own sources of experts, and they created their own media. So they created these think tanks where they have, you know, in case liberal academia says something they don't disagree with, they're ready to undermine it. But I think it's even deeper than that. I think those are the explanations at the surface. But then you have to start looking at all the research we now have on personality types, psychological traits, and you find that we are also dealing with people who have more fixed beliefs and who are less open to new experience and new information. So that's also clearly a key part of it.
Well, let's talk about that, because that is one of the more prominent features that you're discussing is a personality type. Now, I mean, if we assume that there, what are these people new? I mean, in other words, you know, there's the study that shows that educated conservatives have actually come to distrust science more, I guess, or have less trust in science over the past 30 some odd years. If it's a personality type, and go into this a little bit more as to what the personality type is, but if it's simply a personality type, why does this seem like it's a new phenomenon?
Well, because a personality type can, you know, a group of people with that personality can be activated and can get more involved in politics. And that's exactly what happened during the time period in question. So we always need to explain things both at the surface in terms of political events and also below the surface in terms of sort of psychological dispositions. And in the United States, there's a really strong argument, which I develop in the book, but it's not originally mine. It's from a couple of political scientists called Mark Hetherington and Jonathan Weiler that says that when we had the culture war battles of the 60s and 70s, which are what divided America dramatically, what happened was the psychological makeup of the right changed. And it changed because a lot of people who hadn't been engaged in politics anymore or who had been Democrats who had an authoritarian personality disposition moved to the Republican Party. And they've got polling data on this. So over a long period of time. So that's a key part of it.
I mean, it's part of it. I mean, you know, when we talk about that split, and we've talked about that split on this program many times, particularly in the sense of a cleavage that happened between sort of the social liberalism and economic liberalism. In other words, unions splitting off in many respects from the social emancipation movements of the 60s. Tell us a little bit more about what an authoritarian type of person is. And are they reacting on some level? I mean, is there a connection between the notion of science and social emancipation? I mean, we'll speak to that first, and let me see if I can draw that out a little bit.
Sure thing. I think the definition of an authoritarian, it's a personality type or a disposition in which a person, you know, they tend toward the conservative end of the spectrum. But what really marks them out is that they don't really like uncertainty, ambiguity, and, you know, they tend to see things in a very black and white, my way or the highway sort of way. They test this now by asking whether if you're going to have children, you'd prefer to have children who are curious and explore, or whether you'd prefer to have children who are obedient and do what you say. Authoritarians like obedient children. Okay, to liberals, this is like really shocking. But there's a lot of them in America. And so it goes along with a certain type of rigidity, a certain type of closed-mindedness, and it tends to be something you find a lot in religious Christian conservatism in particular.
Do you think that the Republicans simply just found that there was just more of an audience? I mean, how did that come about? I mean, so much happened in a sort of a 10-year period to sort of change the nature of our politics. You know, we talk about this period of the early 70s when you start to see this this drop in trust by educated conservatives was also coincidentally just around the time that Lewis Powell's memo basically, and this is a guy who obviously had some investment in the, or saw the problems of science, because this was a guy who was, you know, starting to, was I think at one point representing tobacco firms. And obviously science was sort of problematic to their bottom line when we started to be able to say with some assuredness that tobacco causes, smoking causes cancer. Was it an accident? I mean, was there some realization at one point on the part of Republicans that, hey, you know, we have a potentially new audience here and they can be activated like this? How did that come about?
Well, I talk about the Powell memo in my book. I think there were several strains, and they all coincided. I mean, the business community was fighting back against regulation, increasing regulatory power that they perceived from, you know, newfound agencies like the EPA, which Nixon created, right? We now find that a very strange thing. So they were doing that. I'm not saying that they are necessarily the authoritarians, but what you had at the same time, although obviously the think tanks they created would then come to appeal to many of the views that motivate authoritarians. But at the same time, what you had was a new focus on issues surrounding race, okay? And authoritarianism tends to be, you know, black and white, literally black and white, less tolerant of difference. And also, you know, issues involving church and state separation. You know, authoritarians care a lot about religiosity, this idea that this is a Christian nation, and here we have, you know, lawsuits over church-state separation, all these things about, you know, women's rights, gay rights, authoritarians believe in a traditional family. So they got activated by the culture war issues, I would say, even as the business community was going and doing its own thing and starting to invest all this money in think tanks. So I think both of them go together.
And not just coincidentally. I mean, I think that there was at one point that there was a realization in the Republican Party that we can motivate at least a lot of these religious fundamentalists. And to take what you're saying a little bit further, I would also say that, you know, science is what brought about in many respects a lot of the aspects of the emancipation of women, you know, particularly in the form of the contraceptive pill, particularly in the form of reproductive rights, all of which then also coincidentally increases the sort of the economic pressure that a lot of these white men, frankly, are feeling because suddenly there's more competition in the workplace.
I think that's absolutely true, and this is why I explained that, you know, an authoritarian in a different culture could believe a different thing, but generally they're going to have a hard time with science. And generally, conservatives are going to be more opposed to science than liberals for the fundamental reason that science always drives change. It drives things to be different. It drives us to be different and better than we are. All right? And we're talking about conservatism as a psychological and political disposition to resist change. It's really that to keep things the way they are, to keep the hierarchy in place. And so science is always going to be getting into uncomfortable fights with that, going back all the way to Galileo. And so it's still happening.
And, you know, I had mentioned to you just before we started the interview that I was on the Dylan Radigan program and just happened to be on when Neil deGrasse Tyson was on. And Neil deGrasse Tyson was talking about obviously talking about space. And, you know, the guy has an incredible sort of infectious quality about his enthusiasm for exploration, and he was talking about how this country needs to sort of regain that same level, that desire for exploration. He was talking about how it can be sold to those who don't sort of appreciate the value of knowledge for knowledge's sake by the tremendous amount of economic development that ends up coming from it. And it was interesting because he was asked a question at one point about Richard Branson and about his travel. Space travel, and deGrasse said, "Well, you need government. This is not something that we can do. An individual can do. He's just going. He's just basically taking a ferry ride and going back and forth. We need government and sort of the power of all of us together to sort of solve the problem of how do we continue to explore and innovate." And I was talking to him afterwards. I was saying, you know, you understand that that is the one of the fundamental reasons why the conservatives don't want to promote science, is because if you show, if we continually prove that it takes government, that government action can take place, and science is one of the best realms in innovation and technology, when are one of the sort of the premier functions that, that government can do things that take a societal response, that undercuts the entire sort of bedrock of conservatism. I mean, how do you think that we can deal with this problem that we have some large percentage of our population that just is not interested in science?
Rough, you know.
Yeah.
Government, I mean, no, government investment in science creates Googles. All right, this is the reality of the situation. But Tyson knows this very well. He points out, he's a complete hero in terms of public engagement with science, first of
yes.
all. And he points out that people, you know, people see NASA as something special and a little different from the federal government they hate. So NASA has a little bit of a PR advantage because it's in all the movies and stuff, and it's kind of glitzy. But, yeah, that is the deep-seated thing. You know, I mean, the right has rallied so emotionally and so strongly against this idea that they've got to fight oppression, and oppression is government, and it's now infused all kinds of different issues, and it isn't just economic conservatism, it's religious conservatism that's lining up against, behind this view with its rigidity, with its, you know, unwillingness to compromise. So it's really, you know, it's really hard to get back to this kind of bipartisan era that Tyson's talking about when putting money in science lifted all boats and gave us the America that was sort of the world leader for half a century. I mean, it's just hard to envision now.
Well, I mean, so how do we deal with this? I mean, you've written two books on essentially the Republicans and their sort of perspective on science. Do you have a solution?
Well, there's two solutions. There's first the one that will never work, because they'll never allow it, all right? And this is the one where liberals say, because liberals are fine with, like, listening to other perspectives, we say, all right, guys, we got all this science about who we are, and if we would accept it, then I think there's grounds for a truce, all right? Let's face it. You know, liberals, we do the science thing, we get the facts, this is what we like to do, just let us do it, all right? We respect that you guys have strength, too. You know, you're very good at sticking to your beliefs, you're very good at staying on target, you're very determined. I mean, this is why you keep being so successful with your old Tea Party thing. All right, we recognize that strength as well. Let us be the curators of knowledge, and, you know, but we recognize that there's an important role for you guys to play in terms of, you know, sticking decision-making, especially in foreign policy, especially in tough topics. Fine, as long as you accept reality. You know, that would be kind of a neutral compromise or an attempt at one. I don't think they'll do it because I don't think they will accept the science of who they are any more than they'll accept the science of global warming. So what does that mean? It means that we have to learn and study what kinds of responses they are actually being successful at with the broader public. In other words, we've got to figure out what it is about Republican psychology, Republican communication that moves the middle. And that's who we have to go for. And we have to realize that there's a lot of ways we haven't been appealing because of our own psychological traits and assuming that everybody's like us. So there's still something to learn there, but it's something to learn about how to move independents, move moderates more towards liberal solutions that we can agree on, and you just got to forget the right until it sort of sorts itself out if it ever does.
Well, what I mean, you're talking about sort of an electoral strategy. I mean, I think, you know, there's definitely some argument as to. We have a legislative problem as well, even when we have a Democratic president and two chambers with a Democratic majority. So how would we speak to move that middle, and to what ends in some instances?
Well, I think what a lot of the research on left-right psychology is showing is that there's certain ways of, you know, for, in terms of leadership, a politician's leadership skills, certain ways of behaving, acting, speaking that the conservatives get that liberals don't. So there's decisive leadership qualities, you know, taking a stand, not backing down. That resonates with the public, and, you know, I think President Obama has not always quite gotten that. I mean, he's had his moments, but it resonates because people, you know, naturally, instinctually feel that this is someone they trust if they act in this resolute way. And liberals have a problem with resolute acting. Liberals have a problem with unity, with being on the same team. We're all in it together. You know, we're going to stay the course, stay the course, stay the course, stay the course. This is a conservative trait that works really well. And if you want to appeal to the broad base of America, you got to signal that. Liberals also, they seem to have a, you know, this is something that Jonathan Haidt has argued, they seem to have a more limited moral palette in terms of the kinds of things that get them really emotional. And, you know, a lot of other things are appealing to Americans and making them feel than the things that appeal to liberals. Liberals, it's always about equality and always about, you know, protecting people from harm. But conservatives have a lot of other things that move them, too. So we can learn how to reach more people by understanding how the right does it.
And essentially, I mean, so at the end of the day, you're suggesting it comes down to a messaging issue?
Well, it's more than messaging. I mean, it's also a movement. But it's also leadership, it's unity. I mean, you know, at the end of the book, I say, you know, I've been watching these environmental issues for a decade. How many environmental groups do we have? How many niches do they fill? And how hard is it for them to agree? It's sort of, it strikes me as bizarre. You know, there's a fortune in environmentalism. There's all these different groups, and they seem to be less effective than the sum of their parts should be. Why is that? This is like a liberal curse. This is, oh, you know, everybody's got to be different. Everybody's got to have a chance to speak, and you have your perspective, and you have your perspective. And half the groups are attacking the other groups because they don't like their way, and they want to stand out and be different. And we hobble ourselves. So I think that's where conservatives, you really learn something from them, is in terms of their fixity and their willingness to not compromise. I'm not saying we should adopt their actual policy views, but this style is effective.
But is it possible? I mean, is it possible to sort of adopt the MO without actually having the same belief system? I mean, I share your frustration on some level of the that liberals are marked by an openness and also by a sense of sort of having very specific niches that are sometimes sort of not as politically powerful as they could be. But I mean, can you really change your stripes in that fashion? I mean, you know, can you, can a lion really sort of dress up as an elephant type of thing?
Well, I'll say this, and it is a good point. It is difficult, but liberals are the people who like change. Unlike conservatives, right? Liberals are the ones like, oh, new information, this is great, because we'll use it, and we'll do it different, we'll do it better, we'll do it right this time. They love that. That's kind of natural. So I think this information is going to get processed in that way. I mean, I don't think that we're really going to be, you know, marching in military lockstep. No. I think that's going to feel very weird to people, too weird, it's going to get a veto. But the observations that are coming out of the psychology research on left and right do point in this clear direction. That's where the conservative strength lies, that's where the liberal weakness is in mass politics. And yeah, I think that information is totally going to be processed, it's going to turn some heads, and then the way in which people act upon it is, it's not going to be military, all right? It's not going to be totally disciplinarian, but it is going to be processed and taken into account.
Chris Mooney, author of The Republican Brain, The Science of Why They Deny Science and Reality. We'll have a link at majority.fm to your book. Thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be with you.